Shalom. It's good to be here. It's actually good to be in church and to preach from the pulpit rather than from Zoom. I really miss this, it's really good to be here. Yesterday, I presided at the funeral of a friend, Jacques Guggenheim. I'd like to say a quick word about him. He was born in 1931. He survived the Holocaust as a child hiding in Switzerland. He said he discovered he was Jewish when he was 10 years old, when a school playmate in the schoolyard punched him in the face and said, "This is for you, dirty Jew." And that's how he discovered he was Jewish. And later on in life, Jacques grew to understand more about his Jewish identity, especially when he gave his life to Yeshua, the Jewish Messiah. And so he served the Lord in France as a missionary to the Jewish people for about 60 years. And he died just last January at a ripe old age of 89. And I had the privilege of celebrating that funeral yesterday. He was a friend, and I was privileged to be able to speak to his family, all of whom did not... Oh, I can take this off? Oh, great. Okay, great. So I was able to minister to his family, whom I'd never met before, none of whom were believers in Jesus. So Jacques kind of led this lonely life as a believer, as a Jewish person, and also as a Jewish believer in Jesus. When he was preaching and speaking and teaching, he was kind of a bit of a UFO for many people. Never heard of that. You know, it was very, very new. And so I was able to, if Jews for Jesus had some fruit over the years, which we have, I think it's thanks to people who worked so hard and saw very little fruit of their labors, but Jacques was faithful to the end, so I'm very grateful for his life and ministry. And so it's kind of fascinating that I did this funeral yesterday, and then Dale asked me to preach on a funeral that Sophie just read in John chapter 11. So this is Jesus outside of the countryside of Judea and Jerusalem, because if you remember when I spoke in December, on Hanukkah, Jesus was in Jerusalem the last time for Hanukkah. And in that famous moment of commemoration and celebration, Jesus said fateful words that the Jewish leadership could not hear. "I and the Father are one." And then they picked up stones to stone him. He barely made it out with his life and decided to let things cool down and sort of left Jerusalem, left the hill country of Judea, and tried to stay away for a while. And then in the story, as Sophie read, dear friends of his, Mary and Martha, send word to Jesus saying, "The one you love, Lazarus, is sick. Please come quickly. Please come and help. Please come and heal," as Jesus had done so many times. Jesus did something kind of strange. He decided not to go. He decided to stay another 2 days. And when he stays another 2 days, he tells his disciples it's time to go back to Judea, and he said, the disciples said, "But you can't go back to Judea because they're looking to kill you." He said, "Well, I have to go back because Lazarus is asleep and I have to go wake him up." And so they said to him, "Well, Lord, if Lazarus is asleep, that's good. That means he's getting better. That means everything will be fine." Everybody knows that restorative sleep is sometimes the best medicine. And he said, "Well, maybe." And so John writes, they didn't understand what he was saying, because it's new language. It's something to kind of keep in mind. For them, it's a new language, it's a new concept. He said, "No, what I mean is Lazarus is dead, and I'm going to raise him from the dead." So he goes to Bethany. Mary comes out, falls at his feet, and says, "Where were you? Where were you? If only you had been here, this wouldn't have happened." And he goes to the tomb. He's moved. He confronts Martha. Martha tells him the same thing. "Lord, we thought you loved him. We thought you would have been here for us, and you weren't, and now look what happened." And he goes to the tomb, and the shock to all is that not only he says, "I am the resurrection and life," he actually brings forth Lazarus out of the grave. Now, John, as Dale said, has been saying some very substantial things in his gospel that the other gospel writers did not say. And the question is, why did John pick these things? He picked them in a nice and neat, orderly fashion. He did seven sayings of Jesus in the Gospel of John that have become world famous. The "I am" sayings: "I am the bread of life, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, I am the gate, I am the door, and here I am the resurrection," or just simply, he says to the leadership sometimes, before Abraham was, I am. Now, all these things are, as they say in good old American English, them are fighting words. And so, but the question is, why did John pick these? Because this is also not only the seventh I am saying, this is also the seventh miracle. And you know that seven is that number of completion in the Bible. So there's something very substantial going on here. But John said, you know, lots of people have written lots of things about Jesus. I know the guys who wrote the other Gospels, and they just said good things too, but there's some things you don't know yet about Jesus that you absolutely have to know. These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So that's what John's goal is. He's trying to tell us who really Jesus is, to confront what we think about Jesus to who Jesus really is. This is what is happening to Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. They're confronting who they think Jesus is. Yes, we know you're the Messiah. And they're coming to discover who he really is. Yes, he is the Messiah, but he's so much more than the Messiah. A little something about Jewish tradition to help us understand what's going on in the text. Now, it begins with a memory that John has of Mary, who anointed Jesus' feet with a very costly perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Now, that was something that hasn't happened yet. John's remembering it. It'll happen later. It'll happen in the next chapter, I think. And costly perfume was sometimes up to a year's salary for people at that time. It wasn't as easy to make or as easily readily accessible today. Touching a person's feet, even though it might seem strange today, we live in a world where we wear socks and shoes and have pedis and manis and wash and have soap and our feet are usually in generally good condition. If not, we have podiatrists who take care of our feet. Not at the time. At the time, the foot was considered probably one of the most disgusting things you could have. In fact, in Jewish tradition, rabbis were ultimate masters of their disciples, and they could ask them to do anything they want. They could ask them to cook, to clean, to help take out the garbage, you know, build a house. No matter what, they had absolute authority on their lives. There's only one thing that a rabbi was not allowed to ask one of his disciples to do, was to wash his feet, because it was considered the most degrading to human dignity. And John said of Jesus, I am not worthy to touch the sandals of his feet. He understood who he was dealing with. So John's saying, I'm not worthy to do something that I myself am forbidden to do to my disciples. And so the power of Mary, who's a woman who should not touch a man anyway, but touching the most considered the most unlikely place in the body, was to express who she understood finally Jesus was. And that's sort of the prelude of this story. John's saying it's going to work out. All of this is going to work out. Another thing about Jewish tradition in this is that usually mourning goes on for about 7 days. And there are several rituals. So every day there's prayers, every day the family comes. And what's interesting in this passage is that the mother and father are kind of absent. And there's no mention of other brothers and sisters. So this is very unique, because families back then had lots of brothers and sisters, because there was security in that. There was prosperity in that. There was a sort of a collective effort to keep each other safe and healthy and work together and grow. And in Jewish tradition, usually the mother is the first one who leads the mourning. There's nothing worse for a Jewish mother than to lose her son. And the fact that she's absent may lead us to believe that maybe these children no longer had their parents. People died quite a bit more often than in our day, in the biblical times. And so Lazarus was not only the person who was a brother, but in that Middle Eastern context, who was going to become the patriarch, who was going to take care of the two sisters. So the situation is very dire for Mary and Martha. It's about their future security and livelihood that we're dealing with. So things are desperate. It's not just mourning, grieving a loved one. It's insecurity about the future, about what is going to happen to us now. And lastly, one thing we should know about Jewish tradition is that in Jewish tradition, we think that when someone dies, they don't die right away. In Jewish tradition, someone dies usually 3 days afterwards. Now, there was a famous, I'll explain. I mean, for Jewish tradition, it seemed they think that, or especially at that time, they still do today, they think that the spirit sort of hovers over the body, and he doesn't really leave until 3 days later. It's after 3 days that the person is really dyingly dead, if you will. So there was a famous rabbi who died in New York. He was a rabbi of one of the largest Hasidic movements in the world. His name was Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And Schneerson died and was buried in Long Island. I was in New York at the time. And his disciples came from all over the world, from South Africa, from Australia, from France, from Israel, of course. All they missed the funeral, but they got there at the graveside. And they waited. 1 day. 2 days. 3 days. And finally, on the fourth day, they left. Because now it was done. He was dying dead. So this is kind of the issues that are going on. Jesus is coming to a tomb. Now, Jesus has resurrected people from the dead before, but usually those cases in the Gospels, the person had just recently died. Here, he's trying to send a message that he has power over death. Nobody speaks more eloquently or funnily to death than Woody Allen. He did say, I didn't write it down, I think Jeff will help me remember, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it comes. But here's a more serious one of his. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment. And a little bit more serious one, someone who wrestled with the thought of death that kind of tortured him was Albert Camus. And this is what he said. There will be no lasting peace either in the heart of individuals or in social customs until death is outlawed. Now, it's interesting. I've done 8 funerals in the past season of COVID, a bit of funerals. So yesterday was my 8th. And I noticed that people have different ideas about death. One is it's sort of a peaceful farewell, especially if there's a morgue and you can actually see him and the person's well-dressed and there's makeup. So everybody gets a sense that it's a peaceful departure. Or if a person's been sick for a while, they'll say, like in French, c'était une délivrance. He was finally freed from his sufferings. What's interesting is, even though it's laudable, maybe it's a way to deal with that moment, I recognize that during the funerals that I've been to, everyone tends to stay away from the coffin. No one likes to get close to the coffin. Also, people feel very uncomfortable with holes in the ground. It's kind of like they're looking at a jail cell with the open cell door, and they know they're going to go there. And they don't like it. So I think that secondary feeling that I get at funerals when people are there is that sense of malaise, maybe even I'm a bit embarrassed. People are afraid to look at each other or to look at what's happening to that person. And I think that's a better way to look at death. The Bible looks at death in a very stark manner. Death is an enemy. Death is an intruder. Death is not part of what God intended for the world. The Garden of Eden was a place where we were supposed to live immortally, in our apartment with Woody Allen. Death is not a part of God's plan or a part of his choices for you and I. Death for Mary and Martha came as an intruder. They said, Lord, if you'd only been here. God, where were you? Where are you, Lord, in our times of suffering? It was obviously not Lazarus' time to die. They felt it was an intrusion. It was an interruption to what was happening, good things that were happening in their life. And so Jesus says, well, I'm here now. Maybe I wasn't there then, but I'm here now. And Martha says, well, I know. I know that he will be raised from the dead, and I know that you're the Messiah. I think I understand what Martha means by I know. And Jesus sort of challenges her faith. See, when I grew up, I thought the Messiah would be Superman, that he'd be a man of steel that could jump over tall buildings with a single bound. And, you know, I was in America, so we thought he'd defeat Russia as well during the time of the Cold War. Jesus, is challenging Martha's faith about what she believes in. Sure, I am the Messiah, but how does it help you to know that I'm the Messiah here? I am so much more. You don't really know who I am, Martha. I am. I am life. Do you believe this? I am life. Jesus is life, the antithesis of death. So Jesus says a couple of contradictory things in here that caused me to ask a question. In verse 15, he says, that wasn't read by Sophie, it says, Lazarus died, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. He says, I rejoice that you weren't there. He says, I'm happy for you because something is going to happen here through this suffering that's going to be in your best interest. So God's absence is not always absence, but it's actually him working things out for our own good. We'll get back to that in a second. But the other contradictory saying is, the other contradicting thing that happened is that it says in verse 33 and 35, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. And then Jesus wept. And then, so Jesus again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now that's strange because Jesus knows what's going to happen. He actually told the disciples what's going to happen. Lazarus is sleeping, I'm going to go wake him up. This is not, the end game is not for death. He says that at the very beginning. He says, this is not for death. He said, I highlighted it here somewhere. Yeah, this sickness is not meant for death, but it is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. So why is he crying? Why is he moved? Why is he troubled? Well, to that, I was kind of looking, I'm not a Greek scholar, so I have to depend on commentators, and pretty much every single commentator that I read said, the Bible translators feel uncomfortable with what the Greek really means here. Because the Greek says that Jesus, it describes him physically. He's snorting like a horse. He's quaking. He's deeply moved. He's a mess. This is very obvious to anybody who's been at a Moroccan funeral or an Israeli funeral. At funerals, they pound on the coffin and are falling and fainting all over each other. You know, and sometimes in the funerals I've had to literally carry people because that's the expression of grief. It's like the last hope. And so Jesus tends to do that. There's another verb that's used here that is, and I'd like to quote someone, Benjamin Warfield. I don't know if you've heard of him, great old theologian. He says that the natural suggestion of the word groan or moved in our translation is pain or sorrow, not disapproval, and this rendering is misleading. What John tells us in point of fact is that Jesus approached the grave of Lazarus in a state of irrepressible anger. He did respond, but the emotion which tore his breast and clamored for utterance was just rage. Death is an intruder. Death is the enemy. And Jesus is the antithesis to that. Jesus is life. Jesus is resurrection. And so John says, these are written so you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. So John chose this because he wants to tell us something about Jesus in this passage. Jesus is not the man of steel I thought he would be. He's a man of sorrow, acquainted with grief. Why is he crying? Why is he so moved? Because it says three times in this passage that Jesus loved Lazarus and Mary and Martha. It says that all the Jewish people around that knew that he loved it. It says, see how he loved him. And so he is that person who is mourning with those who are mourning. But more than that, he realizes that death is the enemy. He is his enemy, and he's here to defeat him once and for all. If we'd only believe. This is something that's been building in John through the I am sayings. This is something that has been building in John through the miracles. But this is something that's been building in John through his own sayings. So remember, right before, during the Hanukkah event in Jerusalem, he says, I have the power to lay down my life, and I have the power to take it up again. This is the commandment I received from my Father. Jesus claims to have power over life and death. Or in John chapter 5, it says, truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. And he has given him authority to execute judgment, Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. If you believe, you will see the glory of God. This death is not for this, the end game is not death, it's for the glory of God. The glory of God is to know who Jesus is, to be, to have that revelation that he and the Father are one. And so Jesus introduces a new concept that the disciples couldn't understand. Lazarus is sleeping. And that's what death can become to those of us who believe in him. 4 days, not of resuscitation, but of resurrection. From death and decay and decomposition to resurrection. Martha says, it's over. He's dead. He's decaying. He smells, she says. You can't open the tomb. Jesus said, if only you would believe. The very first miracle, so like I said, this is the seventh miracle, and it's the completion of this series of seven miracles, but the very first miracle is very telling, because it's at that first miracle that John says that they first believed in him. They saw his glory. They knew who he was. And it was the miracle of turning water into wine. This was not a trivial thing. All Jews grow up, before drinking a glass of wine, they grow up saying these words. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam borei pri hagefen. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, creator of the fruit of the vine. For Jewish people, God is the one who has given us this mysterious fermentation process that gives us wine. God is the only one who can create something from nothing. That word in Hebrew, boreh, means is only attributed to God. And so the disciples took up that cup at that wedding with all the guests. And the disciples knew that the wine was created by Jesus, and they find themselves saying, blessed are you, O Lord our God, creator of the fruit of the vine. Jesus created the fruit of the vine. And here, in this seventh sign, again, he is in a work of creation, a work of bringing decomposition into composition, creating from death and decay into life. Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? When I was a young missionary, I was trained by Jan Moskowitz, who's no longer with us, and he said, Josh, at the end of every sermon, you always have to ask yourself this question. So what? So what does any of that mean? How does it change our lives today? One of my favorite movies, when I was thinking about this passage, I was thinking about a favorite movie of mine called The Godfather. I love this movie. And it opens beautifully with Don Corleone accepting wedding guests, and people ask him favors on his wedding day, and it's a tradition that they're supposed to give him favors. So someone comes and says he's been terribly wronged, his daughter's been hurt, and he says, will you come and help me? And so Don Corleone says, if you had come to me before, this would have never happened, because they would have known that I was your friend, and my friends would be your friends, and your enemies would be my enemies, and then they would fear you, and then they'd respect you, but you didn't come to me before. It's a similar passage in the Torah, where God says, if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. Now, we need to not take that so literally as enemy, but enemy in Hebrew, or adversary, is the one who opposes us, or the situation that opposes us, or the thing that is against us. And God, in this passage of the Torah, is saying that if you will listen to his voice, he will make sure nothing can stand against you, that nothing will prosper against you. Honey from the rock. In the wilderness, the Jewish people, thirsty, drank water from the rock. And God said to them, well, that was nothing. That was absolutely nothing. Oh, that my people would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. I would soon subdue their enemies and turn my hand against their foes. And he would have fed you with the finest of the wheat. And with honey from the rock, he would have satisfied you. That rock, that unyielding place, that is why Jesus rejoiced when Lazarus died. Because here comes the paradigm shift of the gospel, is that God promises that those unyielding places, those hard places, those suffering places will become gifts from us, will be places where we get sweetness and food and nourishment. The deserts become oases. So what do you need today? Jesus, through the I'm statements, Jesus is not saying, I have it. Jesus is saying, I am it. You're hungry, you want bread? I don't have bread, I am bread. You're hungry, you want water? I am water. Are you afraid of death? I am life. And I've come to turn death against itself. If you need comfort, Jesus will sit down and cry with you and comfort you because he loves you. He says, behold, I am with you always. Do you need to be confronted in your own ideas about life and death? And maybe you don't know who Jesus really is. Then that's what he's here to challenge you to as well. He is life. He is resurrection. Are you worried about a child that's sick, a variant of the coronavirus, financial insecurity? Let him do what he did to Lazarus. Let him take on death on your behalf. Let him become the enemy of your enemy. Let him rescue you from the grave. But to do that, we have to hear his voice, just the way Lazarus heard his. Lazarus means in Hebrew, God helps. God helps him. So you could just replace your name in the name of Lazarus and just hear Jesus telling you, come out, you are mine. That child is mine, not yours. Then you can say what Paul said, death is swallowed up in victory. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us this victory through our Lord Jesus Christ.